Hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, the creator and host of this series. And for anyone there who doesn't already know me, I'm also the founder and teacher of Integral Spiritual Practice and the author of the book Integral Life Practice with Ken Wilber. I convened this free teleseries to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a probing public dialogue about how higher consciousness can play a critical role in helping human beings to rise to meet our current challenges, to make as benign as possible a transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. This is the latest in a series of remarkable conversations on this topic with many of today's leading thought leaders and spiritual teachers. Once you've registered at beyondawakeningseries.com, they're all available for free download at beyondawakeningseries.com/blog. This morning, I'll be joined by Lynn McTaggart. We'll continue that discussion in a conversation we're entitling The Power of Eight. The way this will work is that I'll introduce Lynn and we'll spend about an hour having a living exploration, a real conversation about this topic, and then I'll make some announcements, and then Lynn and I will dive in more deeply for the last half hour. So we'll be finishing up in about 90 minutes, or maybe just a little longer. Lynn McTaggart is a best-selling author, a researcher, a lecturer, whose work has rightly been described as a bridge between science and spirituality. For the past 20 years, she's been conducting exhaustive research into medicine and its shortcomings, leading-edge science, and the implications of quantum physics, always looking at what leading-edge science means for us and the world we live in. The result has been the best-selling books, The Field, The Intention Experiment, What Doctors Don't Tell You, and The Bond. Most recently, her book, The Intention Experiment, and his website were prominently featured in the plotline of Dan Brown's latest blockbuster, The Lost Symbol. And she and her book, The Field, were featured in the powerful and inspiring documentary, I Am. She's also appeared on many national TV and radio shows, including The Oprah Winfrey Show and Deepak Chopra shows. She was born in the U.S. and now lives in London with her family. Lynn has been chosen as one of the world's 100 most spiritually influential people by the Watkins Review. Now, what I especially appreciate about Lynn is that she's, well, first of all, whip smart, competent, and really able to think meta-perspectivally about her communication. She not only communicates expertly, but she is able to target her communications at the acupuncture points of culture. She's constantly learning and growing and applying the ideas she works with to help people on a large scale. She's the architect of the Intention Experiments, a web-based global laboratory involving an international consortium of prestigious scientists and thousands of people in countries around the world to test the power of intention to heal the world. And she also instituted the Fairness Campaign to bring the old-fashioned virtue of fairness back into the center of the human community's ongoing conversation. Something she and I are both particularly excited about is the power of small groups of, for example, maybe as few as 6 or 8 people, particularly 8 in the context of this conversation, to become resonant and coherent and to magnify their intention, affecting others and even the whole world. So welcome, Lynn. I'm so delighted to have you on the program today.
Thank you, Terry. It's really nice to spend time with you and with your listeners.
Wonderful. Well, as I said in the introduction, the premise of this whole series and this conversation is to look at how changes in our consciousness can enable us to actually behave differently. We face unprecedented challenges, and therefore it seems that we need to show up with unprecedented capacities, and perhaps higher consciousness has something to do with that. You have built a really impressive body of work. I know that some of it began with your own work with your own children's allergies and looking under the surface of what was going on with standard approaches to medical science, but that then you really probed much more fully into the anomalies and which became more than mere anomalies and really broke huge ground in terms of popular culture as a whole with your best-selling book, The Field, and that's continued with The Bond, The Intention Experiment. Could you offer us maybe an orientation to what you see your work as being and what some of the key ideas are, just in brief?
Okay, thank you. Thank you for all of that, Terry. Well, you know, my work is really about exploring, you know, questions that come to me in the doing of my work. And that's really how I got started into the science and spirituality area. And I think probably as an overview, my work really does attempt to bridge science and spirituality by demonstrating that the latest scientific discoveries are proving now what the ancients and what ancient cultures have been espousing for centuries. And I'm also, my work is also about really looking at unity and looking at holistic systems, because I believe that, and writing a new scientific story, because I believe that the story we have been told about who we are and how we're supposed to live is outdated. And because it is outdated, it is causing us to live in a way that's not in alignment with our true selves, and that's why we're in the mess we're in. And my journey really started out, as you said, through the medical stuff. And, you know, I had always written about, I started out life as an investigative reporter, and I had written a lot of things about medicine and science. And I always kept gravitating toward that in the early part of my career. And then I got very involved with medicine. I helped to launch a newspaper column. I was a managing editor of a newspaper syndicate. I helped to launch a medical column called People's Doctor. And in that column, it was written by a very well-known and revered doctor who was very much part of the medical establishment, but also savaging a lot of standard medical procedure. And that got me very interested in medicine and its failings. And later on, when I moved over to the UK, my husband and I launched a newsletter called What Doctors Don't Tell You. And that carries on to this day, but now in a magazine, to look at what works and what doesn't work in conventional and alternative medicine. Because it seemed to me that over the years as I began looking at it, medicine is very much based, modern medicine is based on a very primitive and materialistic view of the human body, a very, you know, and a dualistic view too. And I started feeling that that was inadequate as I started seeing good studies of alternative medicine, things like acupuncture and homeopathy, and demonstrating this stuff works. And I kept thinking to myself, well, if you can have a thought, as you do in spiritual healing, and send that thought to someone else and make that person better, that in itself undermines everything we think about how our world works. And so that question really began my quest to try to find out if there was something like some sort of field effect. What's responsible for things like spiritual healing and homeopathy? How can you dilute something so much so that nothing of the original molecules is there, and yet have that water essentially be so informed that it can have an effect? And so all of those questions about how alternative medicine works really led me to these three books.
Now, you've gone quite a bit further than what you just described in your latest book, The Bond, in really talking not only about a different paradigm, the energetic substrate of intelligence and embodiment, but the hidden dynamics that connect us and how that affects our understanding really of how we're related and who we are and where our boundaries even lie. I'd love to hear you expand on that a little bit, too.
Well, I look upon these three books that I've written as interrelated in a lot of ways, because my first book, The Field, was very much about, you know, the theory. you know, how can we, as I say, how do we explain things like homeopathy and spiritual healing? Well, we do. It all makes perfect sense if we're not individuated, separate, self-contained entities, but all part of something larger, a larger field. And that's really what that book was all about, that we're all part of this quantum energy field. And the intention experiment was designed to look at the role of consciousness, because it seemed to me that a lot of the studies I was coming across and scientists I was speaking to suggested to me that consciousness is an actual something with the capacity to change physical matter and to actually design our world. So being the sort of hard-nosed investigative reporter that I am at heart, I wanted to know, well, how far can we take this? What does it mean? You know, what does intention mean? You know, can we cure cancer with our thoughts? You know, how far can we take this? And now The Bond was really written to answer the final question. If we're very different from the Newtonian vision that we've been given, then how are we supposed to live? If we're not really actually separate, if we are all connected, how far are we interconnected? What did nature design us to be? And I was really answering not only the Newtonian vision, but I was also looking at the Darwinian vision, which is really essentially the leitmotif of our times, and it has been since Darwin came up with the whole theory of survival of the fittest. Not his phrasing, by the way. His buddy came up with that. But, you know, Darwin was very influenced by theories of population explosion of the day, and he concluded as a result that life must proceed through struggle. And that, in a sense, has been what we have believed, you know, really since the advent of industrialized capitalism, that, you know, in order for me to win, you have to lose, that we serve the common good, in fact, you know, according to the Adam Smith model, we serve the common good by following the course of every man for himself. So I asked the basic question in The Bond, was it supposed to be like that? Did nature really design us to be so competitive? And if not, how were we supposed to be? And in The Bond, after researching, and this time I didn't just look at physics, I looked at biology and anthropology and psychology and, you know, a lot of the ologies. And I concluded that nature hasn't designed us to compete. Nature has designed us in every way to connect. And that when we do, we live according to our nature. And if we don't, we live against nature, which is what we are living in now.
Well, beautiful. So having laid that out, what do you feel are, you know, on the basis of an awful lot of deep reading of science, some of which I want to circle back and explore more fully, but let's begin by tackling the orienting question of this series. In what ways can this awareness of the interpenetration of consciousness and matter and of our essentially cooperative nature, what role does that have, and maybe what else perhaps, or how does that interact with other important features of the of our nature and the nature of human culture to give you hope that we can enter into an era of behaving entirely differently than how we've behaved up until now? Because clearly the human species is happening upon crises. We see breakdowns in our natural world and everything ranging from mass extinctions and habitat destruction to climate change, to the breakdown of most national and international institutions. There's crises in almost every field right now. What gives you most hope, and what mechanisms seem to be promising the kinds of huge effects that we seem to need in the time ahead?
Well, I think that what's giving me hope is that we are hardwired to connect. I mean, it's in every fiber of our being. Nature has designed us to share, care, and be fair. not to compete. And we see this in a lot of different signatures in us biologically. I mean, we are hardwired to feel as good about giving, for instance, as eating or having sex. We need belonging almost more than anything else. And that's why, you know, people commit suicide. Psychologists call it, they suffer from excessive individuation. They feel left out because belonging is the, you know, is primal to the human experience. We need to have fairness. And to every society, the degree to which a society frays has a lot to do with its level of unfairness. And that's why we're seeing a lot of fraying in the Western societies, because so many of them, with the exception of, say, the Scandinavian countries and Japan, are very much following the every man for himself model. And it is, you know, the society is really fraying as a result. So I am hopeful because it's in our nature. I reserve hope because I realize that all of us, even the most so-called spiritual among us, have been imbued. We've been programmed with a certain hard drive now. And that hard drive is all about I win, you lose. And that's in us. I mean, it's been drummed into us from the time we were children, because competition is the engine of every societal structure, the engine of our educational model, of our financial model, of every business, of most neighborhoods, even most relationships. It's all about I win, you lose. And so in order to get back to who we really are, we have to wipe that hard drive clean. So that means a vast re-education program and a lot of practices to get back to the whole idea of I connect whatever it takes. And also, we need to learn how to connect to people who are not like us, because we have even understood friendship as being a connection of people who like the same things, only like the same things. And as you can see, particularly in places like the U.S., people are so polarized now that we have a situation where, you know, university students are ticking a box for their roommates saying, I only want a room with Republicans, or I only want a room with Democrats. It's got that extreme. And so we have to start learning how to connect to people who are not like us, and to value the connection more than I win, you lose. And as I say, that's going to take some reprogramming.
Well, we don't have tons and tons of time to respond to some of these issues. How do you, you know, in the long run, we can all afford to be optimists, but some of this tale will be told in the short run, and we have a lot of daunting problems. As you know, in a grounded and realistic way, how are you able to counsel others to be part of the healthy response to this moment in time, and to really feel that since they're thinking globally, their local action will be part of something that will create a different kind of human story than what we're hearing on the daily news?
Well, in the bond, I attempted to address that. And I felt that, I mean, I want to say one thing, too, is a lot of people, there's been a lot of misinformation, I think, about 2012, just passed by, particularly December 21st, 2012. The whole idea that, you know, that we're going to automatically evolve, you know, that some portal will open up and that we will be able to walk through it and we'll be instantly changed. I think, and I hope now that we're past December 21st, 2012, we found that, you know, A, we have survived, but B, that it wasn't automatic. We're still going to have to do the hard work. And in the bond, I suggested that we have to evolve in four major areas. They were: we need to perceive the world more holistically than we do right now, because we're taught very much to look at the world individualistically, and that is one of our big problems. We see the world in terms of what's in it for me. We see a world of separate things. Not everybody does. Not every culture does. And we can learn to change very quickly. We need to change the very way that we relate to people, so it isn't just about I win, you lose. We need to organize ourselves differently in our friendships, in our neighborhoods, in our towns and cities by enlarging our experience of community and learning to come together for common and larger goals, because that is a instant way of creating closeness. And finally, we have to change our own fundamental purpose on Earth to something more than one based on struggle and domination. We have to step up to the plate and say we're not just spiritual seekers anymore. We have to be spiritual activists, every single one of us. And we have to be the change agent too.
Beautiful. Well, the form of spiritual activism given to each individual is unique. You have particular gifts and at this point a worldwide platform. And so you're a powerful educator and inspirational voice to draw people to the kinds of things you're advocating. Not everyone listening to this discourse has that particular life path. And yet everyone, in order to respond to this, needs to feel like they're a part of the solution in some tangible way. What do you feel are the most powerful ways that individuals can be active in this transition from this atomized way of being to a truly cooperative and healthy and fair, you know, humanity, and not just feel like they're kind of a little person with good intentions being swallowed by a relatively indifferent larger cultural tide?
Absolutely. You know, this is one of our big, you know, errors in thinking. The idea that, well, if we just get the right president in charge, or we get the right prime minister, or we have a big change of government, or the Democrats start talking to the Republicans, it'll all get better. But that's not the way I think it's going to work. One of the things that I'm beginning to work on now is a vast program that I created, a thing called the Bond Handbook, which is a 25-page document that I'm offering free to people who want to create small groups. And my plan is to create loads of bond pods, and I already have a number of some hundreds of them forming now, or already established groups that are working toward this, who are going to work on a 16-week program that helps people become these kinds of spiritual activists. And the whole thing that I'm doing is targeting their local area, targeting a small group. And by group, I mean their congregation, their work group, their neighborhood, even their larger community, their extended family, anything can be a small group, but demonstrating to them how powerful they can be. And one of the parts of that program is just teaching people the power, the absolutely transformative power of just goodness and paying it forward. In my book, The Bond, I talk about Marie. Now, Marie was embroiled in this typical dog-eat-dog office, you know, where everybody was elbowing out the other guy. And she was really tired of this culture. So she was trying to figure out, well, what can little me do? And she decided after a while, well, I can just leave some change in a Coke machine every day when I go and get my Coke in the afternoon and leave a sign that says your Coke has been paid for. Keep the spirit alive and pay it forward. So she began doing this day after day after day, and this, at first, totally freaked out her office. I mean, they started a spy network to hovering around the Coke machine to try to figure out who the secret Santa was. And so then Marie started upping her game, and she moved to another floor, and she began leaving donuts there every day with the same sign. You know, these have been left for you, keep the spirit alive, pay it forward. This became the conversation for weeks. You know, the dinner table conversation for weeks as people began frantic emailing back and forth. And ultimately, it became the catalyst that completely changed the culture of that office. That's how simple it is. And so I have in my handbook, for instance, loads and loads and loads of suggestions for big community goals and also little community goals. But the whole emphasis is local in my handbook and in my own work, because I think that one of the things that we've really lost is the ability to have strong interdependent communities. And if we have these kinds of interdependent communities where people are giving and sharing and working for the good of the community, that tends to transcend differences. That tends to help people feel part of unity, feel the bond. And that can then reach out and be a contagious force that affects the whole community.
That's beautiful. I love that. Thank you. I love that story. And yet, in holding this question, and I think of it as a koan, as a question that's been given to us all by our life circumstance in this time, we all have this unique situation in which we now see this larger trajectory of evolution. We see a new level of understanding of ourselves scientifically along the lines of your work. We see the coming together of all the wisdom traditions, of all the spiritual traditions of the world, and we are able to see that in the context of a scientific mind that can weigh evidence and compare and contrast. We are thinking and seeing globally. We've seen our planet from space. We've got a whole different understanding of who and how we are. Educated people now do think systemically and metasystemically and globally, and yet there are 7 billion of us, and we're obviously way out of balance, and we have an unsustainable human presence on the planet, and there are all kinds of problems that from a mechanistic perspective we can't do that much about. And so people are looking to make a difference. Now, there's a kind of upwelling of goodness that Marie was expressing and that we see in good-hearted, loving, religious, and not necessarily religious people from time immemorial. And that kind of goodness of the human spirit has always been a huge factor in what has made this world and, you know, created, I think, some of our most inspiring art and spiritual and religious sources of inspiration. But if we look at the larger pattern over time, it doesn't seem as though we've changed that much. There's been a larger pattern. There's been a certain amount of selfishness and avarice and envy and conflict, and there's been a certain amount of goodness. And those have been in a rough balance that isn't obviously changing. And yet we are coming across challenges that are global in nature, that actually might affect the whole human species, the whole planet, all the species on the planet. So much more is at stake, and it seems that somehow the effect size has to ratchet up pretty dramatically. Have you given thought to how that effect size can actually scale?
Well, you know, I think the whole idea of any kind of movement is always to start small, because, you know, Margaret Mead, the well-quoted remark, you know, says it always begins with a tiny group, and that's the only way change ever occurs. So it's hard for me to look at the whole thing globally, because I can't see how I could ever have an effect on that. But I can start having an effect on some small groups, and those groups can grow and grow and grow, and they can have an enormous effect on their entire area. So, you know, what my handbook is all about, and what the bond is all about, with the, you know, there are a lot of practices in the book itself about changing the way you relate to people, changing the way you are working with, you work with your immediate area, your groups, working together for a superordinate goal. And let me explain this, because I think this is a really, really key idea about how to change a polarized area to something where everybody is working together. And I'll explain it best by recounting a story I talk about in The Bond. It was one of the most beloved psychological studies of all time. It's called the Robbers Cave Experiment. And it was conducted in the 1950s, and there were a group of 22 boys, 12-year-old boys. They were divided into two groups and sent on two buses to summer camp. And they were encouraged to create separate names for themselves, so they became the Rattlers and the Eagles, separate identities, separate flags, separate living quarters, and they were engaged together in highly competitive games. Now, watching all of this from the sidelines was a group of camp counselors who were actually social psychologists in disguise. And they created, you know, situations that made it more and more and more competitive. They you know, artificially created neck and neck scores. So the boys, after a while, were killing each other. They were, you know, ripping up each other's flags, stealing each other's prize winnings, raiding each other's living quarters. They hated each other. They wouldn't even eat together. So then the psychologists created a series of crises in the camp that could only be sorted by the collective efforts of everyone involved. So they put an impediment in the water supply. Boys had to work together to get it out. They put a truck in a ditch. Boys had to work together to get it out. And lo and behold, after a while, the boys began eating together. They finally started talking to each other. And before long, when it was time to go, they unanimously voted to go home on the bus together, to ride home on the same bus together. And one of the leaders of one of the groups spent all of his prize money buying ice creams for the entire bunch. So that's what psychologists call a superordinate goal. It's a goal that can only be achieved by the collective efforts of everyone involved. And it's been looked at and studied over the years, and it's a time-tested way of bringing people together who might have been conflicted before. You know, you work on something bigger than yourself, your armor begins to fall and you become close. Now, there's also a scientific reason why people start becoming close when they work together on a common goal. Scientists have demonstrated that when we come together for a common goal, our brain waves start resonating in synchrony. When we do things together, our brain waves work in sync. And even our bodies feel better. I mean, there was a study of Oxford rowers that demonstrated that when the rowers row together, they have a higher pain threshold than when they row independently. So, you know, rowing together in every regard raises everybody's game. So, you know, I think one of the real shortcuts, and that's one thing that I recommend a lot in the Bond and in my Bond program, is very much groups and communities working on something bigger. And that doesn't have to be any, you know, you don't have to build a new highway or something. It can be just beautifying the neighborhood. It can be, you know, taking turns gardening or landscaping each neighbor's yard together. I call it barn building because it is a little bit like building a barn like the Amish do. You know, building a fence together, walking dogs together, all that kind of stuff, creating a cleanup committee. It's a neighborhood watch scheme. You know, it's absolutely astounding what happens with those kinds of very, very simple acts.
That's a really substantive answer. Thank you, Lynn. I'm appreciative. I think this particular concept of a superordinate goal that requires us to work together has been a source of a lot of my hope, because it does seem that we're beginning to encounter problems that can only be met by cooperative action. Now, we do see some contravening evidence right now at the time that we're recording this conversation. We're in a time when in the United States there's tremendous polarization, and it doesn't seem like the political parties in our Congress are able to cooperate, even under circumstances where there are superordinate goals that require cooperation. People's divisive identities are trumping their cooperative instincts. And I think that there's a hypnotic power to that kind of news that has us tending to cognize a glass half empty rather than half full. And what I hear you doing is pointing to the water in the glass, to the half fullness of the glass, and orienting people to that sense of empowerment and possibility that really keeps arising evergreen, even in the face of apparently contradictory evidence of division. And perhaps there is maybe a spiritual task at the heart of this that has to do with understanding that no matter how strong the superficial static might be that seems to be giving us evidence of the hopelessness and divisiveness of our world, that we really can be a healing force, and that there are, that fundamentally the deck is stacked, the deck is stacked in our favor, and that cooperation will prevail. Is that an accurate summary of how you see things?
Well, I think we have to, you know, thank you for that. That's all. This is really a lovely high-level conversation, by the way, Terry. I'm really enjoying this. I think it's not automatic. It's there in us, of course. It's there in us. But, you know, we're all so busy holding it back because the whole mindset, the whole paradigm is all about I win, you lose, that we've all been imbued with that. And so we're scared and suspicious. And so we don't want to be the ones to put, you know, to take the first step. So because of this, we have to really relearn, in a sense, how to be. I mean, what I do in what I did with the Bond paperback, I added a couple of chapters that contained a lot of exercises because I realized that this is maybe foreign territory for a lot of people. How do you start looking at things holistically? I felt like we needed to do exercises in it. So I provided a lot of that. I've provided a lot of relationship building skills because, you know, people have forgotten how to do this. We've forgotten how to stop having us versus them thinking. We don't know how anymore about how seeing the whole truth and taking aerial vision so that we can see that, you know, there's not just one version of the truth. We have a real hard time, our idea about, our perspective about relationships now is the idea that, you know, we've got to, first of all, we have to prevail, but also we have to only be friendly with people who agree with us. And, you know, we're so frightened of differences. We feel that they're so, and conflict is so antithetical to us, that if we do have someone disagreeing with us, we find it necessary to totally demonize them. You know, we have to announce their ignorance to the world. We have to debate them. We can only crush them. You know, we have to crush them in order to be right. And if we change our perspective about relationships and to say that the relationship itself is important, it's a thing in itself, and that there is glue there no matter how polarized you are, and to focus on that as an opportunity to create something new together. When you start seeing yourself as part of a bigger whole, you begin to act differently toward people. So, you know, some of the work that I'm teaching now is really about changing that perspective, learning how to share deeply with people because that's an automatic connector. Also learning how to deal with conversational divides. How do you deal with this reasonably? We don't even know how to do that anymore, and certainly Congress doesn't know how to do this.
Yeah, very much so. Well, I want to probe a little bit into the contest of worldviews. If you'll indulge me for a moment, in a sense, we have a mechanistic, you called it utopian, Newtonian worldview, this separated way of seeing the world that in many ways does mirror people's direct experience at least in certain regards. If I don't advocate for myself with the customer service department, I don't get a refund for the defective goods that were delivered to me, you know, that sort of thing. And then there's another view of reality that, you know, my attitude, my orientation creates my own reality. I attract undamaged goods or cooperative customer service folks simply by having a loving and positive and positively expectant attitude and orientation. And we have people who, for very good reasons and in very deeply argued ways, have, I think, successfully challenged both those extreme views. The merely mechanistic view, I think you've pretty much eviscerated it in your writings. On the other hand, there are others who've pretty much eviscerated an overly idealistic and actually utopian worldview that is, I just create my own reality, my wishful thinking generates my reality, this kind of magical thinking, exaggerated extension of this recognition of how consciousness interrelates. The research that you cite mostly shows that intention can affect a random event generator, you know, so that instead of 50% of the time it creates one, you know, black versus white, it creates that 50.7% of the time. That's a pretty large effect size. But in my daily experience, if my intention's only affecting things 50.7% of the time, that's not going to change my life very much. So, and yet I think the effects are much greater than that. I don't think that that's an accurate gauge of the size of the effects of our intention. I think there's more to it than that. I'm wondering how in your own heart, in your own life, you've come to reshape these extreme different presumptions about the nature of reality and come to a resolution that's neither gullibly idealistic nor shut down in a merely karmic and deterministic view.
Thank you for that question. That is a really great one. Well, I think that's where my work sits, is right in the middle of that, because I am very much, you know, there's not much woo-woo about me. Even though I write about so-called woo-woo subjects, there's not much woo-woo about me. I am, as I say, a hard-nosed reporter at heart. And that, you know, in this chest will always beat the heart of an investigative reporter. And so I find it very difficult to accept, you know, kind of facile thinking on even something like an intention, because I do feel that there is a lot of airy-fairy kind of ideas about idealistic view about intention. Well, if I just have happy thoughts. I mean, my answer to that always in my workshops is to say, well, there is some decent evidence demonstrating that you are having a conversation of light with the universe. You are sending out biophoton emissions, and biophoton emissions are coming back from every other living thing in a synchronized fashion. You're having a conversation with the universe. And everybody thinks that if I sit down and I have a power thought, that intention is, and my whole world is determined by these power thoughts. So I get into a meditative state, I send out my power thought, and that's the only thing the universe hears. But, you know, you are streaming out. Everybody's a leaky bucket. We're all streaming out information all of the time. I demonstrate this with all kinds of little fun experiences in my workshops where people find that even strangers are picking up their thoughts all the time. And so we are leaky buckets. We're streaming out our thoughts to the universe all the time. And the problem is the universe isn't just hearing the power thought, the big intention. The universe is hearing every other thought you have, you know, every other judgment you hold, every last mendacious thought you've got. That also is what the universe hears, and that becomes your life's intention. So even if we're going to look at, you know, the idea that our thoughts reflect reality, well, very few of us have very coherent thinking. Very few of us have very positive thinking most of the time. And very few of us really are conscious of what we are sending to the world. So I think that even under that assumption that every thought that we have affects reality, we could have a huge, you know, we are having a hugely negative effect. And secondly, you know, we are not, this is also a very egocentric view of the universe. My thoughts correct everything. I always say that you have to think of the universe as one giant intergalactic superorganism. And when you start thinking of that, the idea that your thoughts are the only thoughts the universe hears is extremely facile.
That's right. The universe is hearing the whole sum total of everyone's thoughts, although some
sure
are probably more powerful because they're powered with a kind of deeper intentionality. I think that there's a kind of difference in the prophetic power, the self-fulfilling prophecy that our own attitudes express is turbocharged when they're anchored with a kind of forceful intentionality rather than the kind of random chatter that's kind of just at the effect of larger forces. I don't think those thoughts are on the same scale, and perhaps by a pretty wide margin. So I wonder how you look at that.
I absolutely agree. I mean, that's one of the things I look at is how do masters of intention do intention, and they have certain practices that are unique to their, you know, discipline. Qigong masters, let's say, might slightly differ from master healers, but at their heart, they do very similar things in order to turbocharge those intentions. And that's really some of the stuff that I look at with a program that I call Powering Up, that I put in the intention experiment, was just that, how to create much more coherency in your thinking, in your thoughts, and how to turbocharge your intentions. So I agree, there is that whole, the bottom line is being that powerful and that conscious takes some practice based, you know, considering the way that we've been brought up in the West. We have to learn how to do this. And so, as you say, you know, there is a middle ground here, and I think that's the ground I like to walk, which is that, you know, I don't think that this is a place, this kind of new view, this new paradigm, isn't a place where, you know, everything is simple and facile. I think it's a place where we have to essentially relearn how to be. In many ways, we have to rebuild, you know, as I wrote in The Field, over scorched ground. You know, we've got to blow up the hole and start again in a lot of ways. But start with, you know, more connection and cognizance of who it is we really are. Because I keep coming back to the idea that I believe that we have been fashioned in our upbringing according to an outmoded, outdated, and ultimately wrong story.
Yeah. Now, if I'm a listener here and I've perhaps read your books, let's say, and I've been inspired and I'm beginning to really try to harness the power of intention in a different way, but I'm also noticing that I'm tending perhaps to be in my enthusiasm for this interaction between mind and matter, I'm sometimes perhaps misapplying my judgment and being a little too credulous and imagining that my intention has a bigger impact than it might really have. And I'm trying to get my handle on the keel and steer right, not steer too far in either direction. What concrete or specific advice do you have to the person who's trying to get a handle on where that dead center is?
Well, I think, you know, there can, you know, you can't say, well, there's a limit. You can, you know, you can manifest a new relationship, but you can't manifest a new car, kind of thing. I think intention requires certain technique and practice, to be honest, just based on so much of the research that I've done. It seems to get better with practice in every regard, whether you're looking at intention in the laboratory or you're looking at it from the point of view of a master intender. So I think it takes practice. It takes certain techniques. It takes specificity. I mean, I think that one of the biggest mistakes people make is they don't tell the universe what they want. You know, I find this over and over in my workshops. People will say, you know, I want to be rich. And I say to them back, is that exactly what you want? Do you want lots more stuff? Do you want to have a yacht? Do you want to have a big house? You know, do you want to have lots and lots of money in the bank? Is that exactly what you want? Well, no, I want to have more free time. I said, well, that's not being rich necessarily. That's just having more free time. Or I want to have more time with my grandchildren. Or I want a different job. I hate my job, and that's what I want, really. Or I want to pursue a hobby and have much more time to do that, and on and on and on. It's not necessarily that they want to be rich. And so I think first you have to really identify what it is you want and then be really specific in the universe, in telling the universe that. We've certainly discovered from, you know, individual cases of intention small group cases of intention, and also our big intention experiments that I run on the internet and now on, you know, television, the more specific we are, the better the outcome.
Right. Well, the more specific we are, the better the outcome, but the outcome of our intention is a little imprecise. And so there's a way that my clarity of intention and the force and the coherence and consistency with which I hold that intention really will have effects. But it's not a one-to-one correspondence. Whereas if I reach out and I close my hand around the coffee cup and I raise it above the table, the chances are 99.999% that the coffee cup is going to simply come up in my hand. I've got really high levels of correlation. Whereas if I intend that I will bring a new level of care and buoyancy and humor and empowerment to my interactions with people today, and I attempt to remember that even in the midst perhaps of complex and sometimes discouraging happenings, the results are going to manifest in a less deterministically predictable fashion. To some degree, I'm going to change things, but exactly how much and in exactly what quantities, it's a little less one-to-one. It's not quite so quid pro quo. It's more about the probabilities and the percentages and the change of the climate of my world and life, especially if I consistently hold that intentionality over time. It'll really change things, but it won't quite be at the same level. And holding intentions that begin to radiate out further, where I'm trying to affect the well-being of someone in my life who I love, who maybe is more troubled, has whatever challenges in his or her life that are beyond the reach of my intention, and yet I really want to make a difference in that person's life, well, my percentages will go down. I can do a lot more with my own life than I can for someone else. And as I begin to extend that out toward my community or my nation or my planet, my effects dilute out further. And yet I want to stay, you know, grounded and realistic and holding these different kinds of causation, both mechanistic and probabilistic, in a balanced way. How can you help guide me to have a realistic and grounded and really positive and clear way of holding all those different realities simultaneously?
Well, as I say, I think that we have to relearn a number of ways of being. And so in the bond, I talk very much about the first way is really learning how to see the world very differently. Because, you know, we are so used to seeing the world in a very piecemeal fashion that governs every way that we react to it. So, you know, when you talk about having a huge effect upon the world, I'm always fascinated by the work of Nicholas Christakis, who is he's a Harvard psychologist who studies social networks and their effect on each other. And he has found that when one person does a kind of pay it forward activity, very much like Marie, it affects 4 degrees down a social network. In other words, if I'm kind to you, you're more likely to be kind to Jim. Jim's more likely to be kind to Sam, and Sam's more likely to be kind to Sally. And it goes down that far each time with every single action. So we actually can quantify things a bit. You can just imagine, I mean, one of the things that his team look at are, you know, the fact that we are so contagious that, for instance, happy people are more likely to have happy friends, not because they self-select happy people to be around, but because of the natural spread of happiness. But the same thing goes with loneliness. You know, it's not just positive emotions and loneliness, even, you know, obesity. You're more likely to affect people to overeat if you overeat. So we're all so socially contagious. But that's a really great force for good in terms of changing areas around you, because, you know, just simple measures like the kind I'm advocating in the Bond and in my Bond handbook, are all about becoming a socially contagious agent of change. The other hopeful aspect of all of this has to do with fairness and unfairness. And I found this really fascinating because, you know, scientists study fairness by looking at games through game theory. Now, game theory are situations where an economist typically will model a tough situation. He'll put people in a tight spot and see how they behave, and from there model human behavior. They do the same thing to try to model animal behavior too. What is this animal going to do under condition X? So they do it with a series of games, and the most common game is the ultimatum game. I'm playing with you. I've never seen you before. I'm never going to see you again. They give me $10, and they say, I can split this any way I want to with you because I'll never see you again. And you can choose to accept it or not. If you accept the split, we both get as I've designated it. If you don't, neither of us get any money. So the assumption is that, you know, that I'm going to keep 9 for myself and give you 1, and that you'll take it because $1 is better than nothing. But this game has been played all around the world, and even with cultures where they don't even have money, they play with tobacco, and the most common split is 50%. So the point I'm making is that scientists understand that fairness is deeply embedded in people, but part of that fairness quality in us, our need for fairness, is a need for people to be fair back. So they play another game called the public goods game. And in this game, a group of us are given $10. And we're all told we can put a certain amount, as much as we want or as little as we want, in a common pot. And that's going to be redistributed to the whole. Now, the secret to the game is the more generous everybody is, the more everybody gets. And indeed, when people first play it, most people are very generous, but a few people hold back a bit, and that starts pissing off the rest of them in subsequent rounds of the game, so that each time the rest start putting in a little less and a little less and a little less until nobody's putting in anything. And that's sort of where we are right now in our society. But the fascinating thing, according to a number of economists, is that all it takes in a situation like that, a culture of greed, is one or two people wedded to fairness and reciprocation, you know, everybody being fair back, to turn the whole game around. Now, that's something that we can take into real life, too, because we are so socially contagious that all it requires is one or two people setting a little standard, going beyond the norm, getting people involved, being a little activist to turn the whole community around.
That's beautiful, Lynn. I want to probe even more deeply into how we are creating this in our own work and in our own lives. I'm doing this whole teleseries as a pro bono offering. People are able to tune in and listen to these dialogues without paying a thing, and it's one of my ways of giving back, and I hope it engenders something of an uplift for many people, and they pass it along to others, and that their way of participating in their lives is enhanced. And I see that you're offering this free booklet on the Bond, and you're intending to give people the resources with which they can embody these things themselves, and that's another expression of this kind of intentionality that we're actually doing. A cynic might turn to us and say, well, yeah, but there's ulterior goods that are accruing to you. You know, Terry, you're promoting your name and your other work that might prosper because people are associated with you. Lynn, you're promoting your work. You're helping people get involved in your initiatives. To what degree is this really completely giving of life energy, you know, because these things accomplish both altruistic and self benefiting results. And And I think that there's a deep cynicism that's been imbued in people. So many times something is offered for free, but it has a business purpose. And I think we're conditioned to believe at some deep and instinctual level that we really have no one looking out for us except ourselves, because so often apparent favors don't end up meeting all our needs. You know, we really are required to be self-responsible in a unique and final way. And it's a debate about those essential aspects of human nature that animates some of the political division in the United States, at least right now, between people who kind of believe that people are basically good and others who believe that people are basically self-interested and need systems of incentive or in order to behave decently, or perhaps in an Ayn Randian kind of a way, believe that people maximize the good of the whole by simply being selfish. How are you working with that and being, you know, in a sense, tough on yourself to really be a beacon for a different kind of morality and truth, so that your gifts are truly experienced as gifts, and so that a different pattern is really being set into motion by your own activities?
Okay, I think everybody can do something to try to further this change along, and they use the tools they have. Now I have a certain notoriety because of my work, and I can use that. I mean, I always think of somebody like Audrey Hepburn, who decided to use her celebrity to work in UNICEF, or Princess Diana, used her celebrity to get rid of landmines. Now, did she do it because she wanted to be on the front pages? Or did she do it because she wanted to get rid of landmines? And finally, does it matter because she got rid of landmines, you know? And so I think the important thing is to use what you have to create the greatest change. And so I felt that I had enough access to people where I could start creating these groups fairly quickly, and that they would ripple out. Now, in terms of my answer to people saying, oh, well, you must be in it for the money, I have in my life found many, many, many easier ways of making money than spending a lot of free time with people building communities. So there isn't really much gain for me in any of that. For everybody else, I think you have to look at what are people really doing, whether that is in their work life, is that in their home life, and are they bringing some real soul to what they're doing? Or are they selling Coca-Cola? You know, one of the things I have in the Bond Handbook is starting to take an inventory of the kind of work you do in your life, because I think that's a real important question, too. What are you doing? And is it helping the planet or is it harming it? You know, we do. I mean, there's nothing wrong with people out there making money. We have to right now, because that's the system we've created, until we change that one. But we don't have to do it at other people's expense. You know, you don't have to win at someone else's expense. And at the heart of the project I'm talking about is changing a paradigm where it's, I win so long as everyone else wins too. And so, you know, it's what I call in the book the Nash Equilibrium. It's based on the theories of John Nash, who came across with the idea that the best response anyone has is not only what's good for himself, but also good for the group. And I mean, it's demonstrated so beautifully in that movie, A Beautiful Mind, where Russell Crowe is there with his, you know, he's the tortured economist stroke mathematician, John Nash. He's a postgraduate. He's with his buddies in a bar. It's the 50s. They see a blonde come in, and all the guys are attracted to her. And Nash says, and everybody's saying, hey, it's every man for himself. Remember the teachings of Adam Smith. And Nash says, no, because if we all go for her, she'll give us all a cold shoulder, and then we can't go see her, you know, we can't go to her friends because no one wants to be second best. But what if none of us go for the blonde and we all choose one of her friends? That's the only way for us to all to win. And he said, you know, Adam Smith was wrong. The best response in any situation is what's good for you and the group. And he went back and he wrote that up to a theorem. I mean, this is, I think, very much embellished, but that theorem ended up winning him the Nobel Prize. And I think that's the kind of, I like that as our new paradigm, because I think looking at it that way, as I say, you know, there is a real issue oftentimes in the consciousness movement saying it's wrong to make any kind of money. No, I think it's wrong to hurt other people. I think it's wrong to do things under false pretenses. I think it's wrong to, you know, to get people to pay for things they don't really think they're paying for, and all of those kinds of things. And finally, it's wrong to do things that are going to harm other people and the planet. But so long as we have a situation where we have to exchange for things, we have to, you know, we have to work in that manner. Now, one of the things I suggest in the Bond Handbook is creating barter systems. And there are a lot of interactive community barter systems. I even talk about creating a community savings bank, or even creating its own currency in the handbook, because I think that's another way of tightening up and making a strong and interdependent community. So it doesn't have to be money, and people don't have to give of money or give of, you know, of time. They can give of some sort of service. But I think, you know, all of us have to start with the idea that we have to change the paradigm. And that's really where we start, no matter who we are or what area of spirituality we come from. I think we have to all understand that this system isn't working for anybody, Republican or Democrat.
Beautiful. Thank you, Lynn. I want to respond to that and delve even more deeply into this really honest and, I think, probing conversation. I'm just so grateful that you're so willing to go into all of this so richly and probe so deeply. But I have a couple of important announcements I want to make first. And first, everybody, I want to make sure that you know how to find out more about Lynn's work. She has a wonderful website, lynnmctaggart.com, where you can find out more about all her work. But what might be especially of interest to everyone right now is that you can sign up on a different website, thebond.net, thebond.net, for this Bond Handbook that she's described. It's a free 25-page electronic book, a 16-week program of weekly individual and group exercises and practices that are designed to turn you into a pioneer for a new world from the bottom up. It's free to anyone who wants to rebuild their community, as Lynn said, an extended family group, a group of friends, even two or three people can begin this process. So you can sign up for a free electronic copy plus instructions about how to communicate with other Bond pods around the world and receive free support from Lynn. That's at thebond.net. She has been writing some of the world's finest information about healthcare, modern medicine, and better alternatives in her publication, What Doctors Don't Tell You. And this is now a 100-page, is this a monthly magazine, Lynn?
Monthly magazine, yeah.
Yeah.
We just launched it in September.
Wonderful. So you can subscribe to an online or a print version at WDDTY, What Doctors Don't Tell You, WDDTYsubscribe.com. Additionally, I want you to be aware of some of my own offerings. You can connect with me and be able to find out more about all my activities. So please sign up on my mailing list, which is different from the regular Beyond Awakening list, by visiting terrypatten.com. That's TerryPatten.com. And there's a free guided meditation of the three faces of God that you'll receive when you do sign up for my mailing list. I'll also be going at the end of this month to Germany, Switzerland, Norway, and Sweden, and teaching in the latter part of this year, and there's some information about that at my website. And it contains information about my teaching, including my online course in integral spiritual practice. If you're interested in my current activist project, please go to integralobama.com, which provides updates on this experiment of working within the U.S. political system from an integral and evolutionary perspective. We're now attempting to influence the administration to write the rules for the implementation of the Affordable Care Act so as to maximize and open a path for increased opportunities for people to use their natural, alternative, complementary, and integrative medical modalities in the national healthcare approach. Also, please stay on the line. At the end of this call, I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up in the time ahead. Well, thank you, Lynn. So, going into this, I think you're expressing a kind of spiritual activism and entrepreneurship, like two root human spiritual emphases. One, a vitality that brings your intelligence and capacity to bear in being as creative and self-actualizing as possible, and therefore creating a hugely influential presence in the world, as the whole English-speaking world is, I think, influenced by your work. On the other hand, you're also really exerting this other spiritual impulse to give and to be a benign effect on others through the pro bono work and just the general intention of your work altogether. One of the things that I notice among really sincere and deep practitioners and activists like yourself is that they're holding questions about how they can do this better and better, even when they're succeeding. And it seems to me that you are you're a paragon of efficacy in many respects, and I'm sure you feel some real satisfaction in all the wonderful ways that your work is affecting people and making a big splash in the world. But I'm sure you're also looking to somehow up the game or to make it more fully aligned or more fully effective or to give your gifts even more effectively. And I'm curious what questions you're holding now, what yearnings you're holding as to how you can break through whatever barriers or, you know, whatever markers you still haven't fully gone beyond.
Well, it'll be really interesting to watch the Bond pods unfold because we've got a lot of people who are just starting. There are some churches, there are groups all around the world who are starting up now, and you know, we're starting out with just about 300 or something, and there are a lot of people, you know, wanting to be part of it every day, and it's just kicking off now. So it's going to be really interesting to watch what happens with these groups. I mean, I'll be in communication with them. And, you know, I want to see this on the ground. I want to see this, you know, I want to move beyond the theory of a book and the research of a book to watch it unfold. I mean, there's an element in me that's always been an activist. I mean, I'm, you know, first and foremost, I suppose, a writer, but I'm also I've got a lot of activist in me. And, you know, I'm an old hippie too, and I think, you know, I really want to see a change, and I'm so tired, even though I sit over here in the UK, I watch my home country with great despair. You know, America is very different from the place I left in 1980, and I want to see things get better there, and I just am so despairing to hear the figures now. How many people are on food stamps? How many people are multimillionaires, and yet how many people are on food stamps? It's just, you know, it's just heart-wrenching for me. How many communities are absolutely destroyed and got destroyed after 2008? So I want to see things starting to be rebuilt. I want to try to do whatever I can. And it seems to me that the research has pointed a way forward. And so it'll be a test. As I say, the best test always is, you know, can it be rebuild a little area? What happens when people start doing this? And, you know, then let's start rolling it out. And there isn't any other, you know, thing. Most of the people who will be part of this probably have already read my work. So, you know, when I get my kicks out of this, in a sense, are seeing something really improve. So, you know, one always tries to do that. I guess my work has always been, I've tried to have some sort of any bit of my modern work for the past, you know, numbers of decades has really been based in some sort of service. What Doctors Don't Tell You started out as 23 years ago. It really kicked off because I got ill personally, and I couldn't find anybody who could sort me out. And I went from very conventional doctors to the very outer rim of alternative doctors, and no one could figure out what was wrong with me or get me better. And so I finally figured out that if I was going to get better, I was going to have to research this myself. And so I researched what I thought I had, and then I found a pioneer doctor, a nutritional doctor who I thought could get me better. And we worked together as a team, in a sense, to get me better that year. And afterward, I probably got pretty boring on the subject. I was proselytizing about it, I'm sure. And so my boyfriend, now my husband of the time, said, you know, don't tell me, tell the world. And so we started out What Doctors Don't Tell You, to tell people about dangers of conventional treatments that don't work and better alternatives. And that always was something that, you know, powered what we do. We get letters, and have had so many letters over the years saying, thanks to you, I haven't lost my leg. You know, and stuff like that can be amazingly gratifying. It's not just about, you know, making a crust. It's about doing something to help in the world. And so that's, you know, been informed my writing. It's informed my work, I guess, all the time.
Beautiful. I want to circle back. I'm realizing there is one thing that I did kind of ask about, but I'd like to discuss it in a little more depth. Very often, some of the scientific evidence for the efficacy of intentionality seems to show relatively small effect sizes, especially when we're talking about intention affecting something as mechanistic as a random event generator. And yet, we are extrapolating from that the premise that we can create much larger effects in our lives and in our world. Could you unpack in a little more detail how you see the interaction between consciousness and matter becoming the grounds for a faith in our intentionality having big effects in our world, so that we can kind of ground that a little bit in your scientific, in your survey of the scientific evidence itself?
Okay, well, you know, that is a question that I've been asking, Terry, really since I began the intention experiment. That's why I began it. I was particularly interested in the whole idea of group effects. What happens when lots of people are thinking the same thought at the same time? Does it magnify the effect? That was my big question. And my other big question was, well, how far could we take this? You know, can we stop a train with our thoughts, you know, or is it just a subtle effect on a random event generator? And that's why I started the intention experiment. And we've run about 25 experiments to date. Two of them we're still waiting for the results, but the rest of them, all but four, have shown measurable positive effects, some of them quite profound. So we're learning. You know, we've been doing effects on water, trying to purify water. We've been doing effects trying to make food grow faster. We've demonstrated, you know, under very robust scientific conditions, we can do that. We've been looking at, can we make crime and violence go down? And we have two very provocative studies showing results that are very interesting. You know, when you have one study, it's a coincidence, perhaps. And when you have two studies, it starts getting interesting, but you really need 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Then you start having a real pattern that's kind of irrefutable. So, and becomes much more interesting. So, you know, it's the ongoing question I have. So the short answer to your question is, I don't know. I don't know what we can do with this. What I do find, though, in plenty of evidence, it's not just random event generators that can be affected by thoughts, but thoughts affect, you know, everything from single-celled organisms to full-fledged human beings and inanimate objects, too. I mean, healing, and there are many robust studies for spiritual distant healing, many of them demonstrate very solid effects. So, and, you know, some studies show more than others, but there are, you know, there's a very good body of evidence for spiritual healing. Even there's a big skeptic over here in the UK called Edvard Ernst, who has had to admit that there are, you know, the studies demonstrate more than not that healing works. So we see that kind of thing that will tend to undermine any kind of skepticism we have about the power of thoughts, the power of intention, because healing is a form of intention, sending a thought to somebody else to make them better. There are a lot of robust studies in the laboratory showing that intention works best in certain effects. I have to say, it's demonstrated over a load of different kinds of effects. As to how this can work in your life, I mean, the best I can do is to look at what happens in individual cases and try to log them. And the area I've been logging it in the most is small group effects, what I call the power of eight, the title of our conversation today, because I've been most interested in the whole idea of small groups as well as big groups, sending intention to somebody within the group, what happens. And I started this 5 years ago during workshops, mainly to just see, well, can we show what intention does in a little group situation like that? So we would nominate somebody within the group. I divide my audience into loads of little groups of 8 to 12, and they'd nominate somebody within the group with a healing challenge, and we would send intention to that person. That group would send intention to that person. And we found two things, to my total astonishment, because I did not think of this as, a healing modality. The people who were being sent intention would much more often than not get profoundly better. And we had all kinds of things. I mean, recently I had a woman with multiple sclerosis walking into my workshop with a cane and all kinds of walking aids. And the next day after her intention, she came in without her cane, and she was walking much, much better. I had a woman with an opacity in one eye, and she said she barely could see out of that eye. And the next day it was 80% better after her group intention. The other really weird thing that started happening is that people sending intention, people in the group with problems, whether it was arthritis or whatever, they would feel better too after doing the sending. So I started observing this, and it seemed to me that there was some sort of virtual circle in this little group intention thing. And I started patting myself on the back a lot and saying, I've discovered something pretty amazing. Until my husband, who was reading about the ancient Essenes, discovered that they used to use healing intention circles. And even Jesus, before he was Jesus, capital J, used to use healing intention circles. So I think it was just an ancient practice I just stumbled on via science. And I used to think it was the power of intention. I now think it is the power of community, because people afterward talk about, they have experiences of a real palpable sense of oneness. They have real experiences because they say, I've never felt so supported. The idea of having a group of perfect strangers sending such loving intention to you is an overwhelmingly powerful experience and possibly healing experience. So I've been observing this a lot, and that's an area of intention that I find really powerful and that I want to encourage people to use in these small community groups, because I think there is a power beyond our understanding about community that we've lost. Ancient cultures have them. I've just been reading Jared Diamond and his information about the New Guineans and how important community is for them. And I think this was always important for us, and we've lost it. But it's an area that we must regain. And I think that is an area where we have to try intention.
Beautiful. Absolutely. I completely agree. And I find it really inspiring. I think it's almost as though the joining together with shared intention breaks a certain spell of apparent dignified rational impartiality, in which we hold back a kind of affiliative warmth and care for one another. And it is as though we've lost our professionalism or neutrality if we go forward and to say, well, Lynn, I really wish you well. I want the best for you. It's as though I've become fawning sycophant and therefore have lost my credibility. And in order to hold my credibility, you know, I've established my credibility in this interview by asking you some devil's advocate questions that are sort of hard questions, and that's kind of how we establish our bona fides. And yet in our actual connectedness with one another, if we aren't really fans of one another's thriving, we are depleting the plenum of the field that's holding us, the bond that's holding us, of much of what animates it most healthfully. Do you agree?
Absolutely. I mean, that is the important element. Just as you put your finger on it, the whole idea of I wish well for you, you know, and, you know, in the bond I write about Orland Bishop, who is working in L.A. with, you know, rival gangs in Watts, you know, and he has this incredible fool's, you know, mission, which is, you know, to try to get these gangs to deal with each other really, you know, kindly and to connect. And he does it by talking to them about some African practices, the practice of Suubono, which is I see you, meaning I see, really see into your soul, you know, and the person saying, you know, we see you back, you know, it's we see you too. It's really we see you, because they believe in Africa that seeing isn't a solitary act. You see with your ancestors too.
Mm.
But he also talks to the about the whole practice of Ubuntu, which is, you know, I am because you are.
Right.
And that whole idea of I put myself in your service. I am at the service of your well-being. And that's something we totally have lost. You know, it's all about I win, you lose. And so learning, that's what I'm saying about we have to really relearn our sense of community and our sense of relationship, because we don't remember that anymore. We've been too imbued with the distrust, the whole idea of Schadenfreude, you know, delighting in someone else's misfortune. My goodness, that's a real favorite hobby over here in the UK. And you know, we forget to delight in somebody else's well-being, but also to be putting ourselves in service to that well-being. And so that's such a shock. It's like a shock of recognition, I think, during these healing intention workshops. People cry, senders
yeah.
and receivers. They cry, they connect. It's so powerful.
You know, it's interesting. One of the philosophical foundations for all of this is the idea, sometimes called panpsychism, that consciousness pervades the whole universe, not just the human beings, not just the animals, or the higher animals, not just even the lower animals, not extending even to the plants, but even extending to inanimate matter, that there's a kind of primitive proto-sentience, the kind of thing that Whitehead referred to as prehension, that's there in an atom. Why do two atoms that were synced up at one time change their spin simultaneously, even if they're now distant from one another? There's a kind of memory even in matter itself, and therefore a kind of proto-sentience just in the very stuff of the universe, the idea being that even subatomic particles like quarks or bosons have a kind of primitive prehension. There's a lot of scientific evidence for that, but coming up to our level of consciousness and our feeling, the implications of that, understanding that we can live in a re-enchanted world in which we are not in a dead and mechanical universe, but we're in a field of mutuality in which our positive care for others is not just a little mechanism in an otherwise mechanical world, but which is a principle in which the whole world is subtly re-enchanted, and which we get that there is an aliveness and a potentiality for communion even in the wind and the light in the sky, that we're not in a dead mechanical pattern of frisky dirt. How in expressing this wonderful, you know, very heartfelt confession that you just shared with us, and then kind of contemplating the philosophical ground of a re-enchanted world, how does that connect up for you? How do you experience that or want others to experience it?
Well, again, you know, we've got, you know, human beings have the masters of the universe view of themselves, you know, that we are at the apex of you know, existence, and that we're at the apex of life. And, you know, we are beginning to, I regularly report on amazing stories of, you know, animal emotion, animal cognition. There was this wonderful story of, you know, elephants understanding and knowing when they had a great elephant trainer who died, all coming and traveling over miles to come to his funeral, even though they'd never been, you know, told in a way that he was dying. They just sensed it. They knew. Came over, paid the respects for a couple of days, and then turned around and went home, you know, miles away. I mean, there's wonderful stories like that for us to understand that, you know, not just living things, but the much more native sense of the world being this holistic whole, you know, that we have to imagine ourselves very differently, but much more humbly. And that's why we call it the, you know, a intergalactic superorganism, because we truly are, you know, we are because it is, you know, in every aspect. And we can only understand ourselves. I mean, we know, and I write about in The Bond, the incredible effect that the sun has on not only our biology, but our behavior. And so, and the other planets too, that there is all kinds of subtle energetic effects, geomagnetic effects going on at every moment. And so if we can be profoundly affected by a ball of gas, all those hundreds of thousands of miles away, then that says something, you know, really profound about the human experience being one of connectedness, profound connectedness. And we can only, and what this really says ultimately, is that we can only go forward if we stop this master of the universe view and stop just exploiting everything around us, other people, other things. Because that's all we do for personal gain. So we have to start really an inventory of our lives in every aspect, including our work. Who is helped or harmed by what I do? What is helped or harmed by what I do?
Those are provocative questions that I live with, and that I'm grateful to you for articulating. And I can feel the spirit of sparkle in your eye and heart that obviously animates your work. I want to thank you for having done so much to help change the paradigm, the worldview out of which so many of us are seeing our world, and marshaling the scientific evidence to ground that. I think you're having a wonderful effect, Lynn. And I'm just so grateful that you've decided to spend this time with all of us and joining us. We're out of time now, but I want to tell everybody about what's coming up next week and offer a few reminders. If you value what you're receiving here, please support our work by letting others know about it. There are a remarkable series of probing and deep conversations on this vital question, the elephant in the living room. How can we make a difference in our world? And they can register for this series by going to beyondawakeningseries.com, or you can forward them the email that announced this to you. If you're interested in learning more about Lynn McTaggart, please visit lynnmctaggart.com, and especially if you'd like to get her free booklet, go to thebond.net, and you can get that for free. You're also invited to go to terrypatton.com to look at my blog entries and to sign up for my personal mailing list and newsletter and receive the free guided meditation. In about 5 weeks, again at our regular time at 10 a.m. on Sunday, February 17th, I'll be talking with Warren Farrell, the author of many books, including The Myth of Male Power, and really the founding father of the new men's liberation movement, who says that men today are about 50 years behind women, and that women and men won't find the real satisfaction and harmony and thriving that we all need until men are as liberated as women are becoming in the Western countries. Thank you so much for joining Lynn and me today. And thank you, Lynn. Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you so much, Terry. It's been a joy. Thanks so much.
Wonderful.